So what is this Sutra of Golden Light? Or as it is sometimes known, the Sutra of Supreme Golden Light. What is it? Briefly, in just a very few words, it's one of the Buddhist scriptures. It's a very popular scripture, a scripture that has been and still is very popular in China, in Japan, in Tibet, in Nepal. And speaking a little technically, it's what is known as a Mahayana Sutra. So when we say that it's not only a Buddhist scripture, but that it is a Mahayana Sutra, this at once raises two further questions. That is to say, what is the Mahayana? And what is a sutra? So first of all, what is the Mahayana? The word itself, which is Sanskrit, means literally the great way, or the great vehicle. And the Mahayana, the great way or the great vehicle, is one of the three major historical forms of Buddhism, especially of Indian Buddhism. And it's important to understand it isn't a particular sect or a particular school. It's much more like a broad, general spiritual movement affecting all aspects of the religious, the artistic, and even the social life. It's a movement, we may say, of spiritual renewal and of spiritual revival. We could even say a movement of reaction against a narrow interpretation of the letter of the Buddha's teaching. We could say that the Mahayana represents a return to the spirit of the Buddha's teaching. But at the same time, the Mahayana is not simply, not merely, a movement of reaction. The Mahayana, the great way, the great vehicle, possesses a positive spiritual character of its own that transcends the immediate historical context. And this character can best be described as universal. The great way, the great vehicle, is universal. Lama Anagarika Govinda, of whom I'm sure many of you have heard, indeed speaks of the Mahayana in these sort of terms. He speaks of the universal perspective of the Mahayana. The universal perspective, which is a very good expression for it indeed. Now I've said that the Mahayana means great way or great vehicle. And it's so called because it is a way or a vehicle for a great number of people, a large number of people. In fact, for all sentient beings. It's a way to enlightenment for a great number of people. It's a vehicle to carry them to the state of nirvana. And for this reason, the Mahayana stresses the ideal of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva is one who is bent on enlightenment, that's the literal meaning of the term, one who is self-dedicated to the highest spiritual realization. But he's bent on it, he's dedicated it, not for his own sake only, but for the sake, for the benefit of all sentient beings, all living beings. And such a Bodhisattva therefore makes, in the Mahayana, four great vows, expressive of his dedication and determination. He vows, however innumerable beings are, I vow to deliver them. However inexhaustible the passions are, I vow to extinguish them. However immeasurable the dharmas are, I vow to master them. However incomparable the Buddha truth is, I vow to attain it. Now, I've spoken of the Bodhisattva. And the Bodhisattva is spoken of traditionally in the scriptures and so on as a person. But if we look at the Bodhisattva closely, or if we try to look at the Bodhisattva closely, if we try to get some idea, some real feeling of what the Bodhisattva is like, we shall soon realize that the Bodhisattva is not really a person literally at all. A Bodhisattva is much more like a sort of suprapersonal stream of spiritual energy, certainly in the later, more advanced stages of his spiritual career. So the Mahayana, the great way, the great vehicle, encourages everybody to become a bodhisattva. And it encourages everybody to aspire to the highest spiritual realization, that is to say, to supreme Buddhahood, for the sake of all. In other words, the Mahayana encourages everyone to cooperate in what it thinks of, what it describes as the great work of universal deliverance or universal emancipation, or if you like, the great work of universal transformation. And for the Mahayana, therefore, the Bodhisattva ideal is a universal ideal. It's universal in its aim, which is nothing less than supreme Buddhahood, universal in scope, its scope being all sentient beings, is universal also in its frame of reference, which is infinite space and boundless time. Now, the bodhisattvas are often described as heroes, even as great heroes, Mahaviras. But of course, we have to admit, not everybody wants to be a hero. Not everybody wants to be a bodhisattva, not even among followers of the Mahayana. Strange to say, some people are quite reluctant to gain supreme Buddhahood. They have to be encouraged. They have to be helped. They have to be given a helping hand. Not to say a crutch or two. So the bodhisattva adopts a variety of what are technically called skillful means, sometimes translated as expedient means. And these are different means, different methods of helping people spiritually in accordance with their present stage of development, in accordance with their particular temperament, their particular position in life, their general outlook on life, and so on, even without their noticing that they are being helped in some cases. In other words, the bodhisattva tries to meet people halfway. He tries to meet them, to encounter them on their own ground. He speaks, he tries to speak, he tries to learn their language. He tries to communicate with them in their language. He tries to make things easy for them. As easy, that is to say, as is compatible with the objective requirements of the spiritual life. Even a bodhisattva, great as he may be, willing as he may be, helpful as he may be, cannot do it for you. He can only encourage, he can only guide, he can only advise, he can only inspire. Your own active cooperation is always required, even if that activity of yours consists simply in being receptive to his influence. Sometimes, of course, the bodhisattva helps simply by being around. Not necessarily by being around in, as it were, his official bodhisattva capacity, complete with his jeweled headdress and his lotus throne. He may sometimes leave those behind. But being around simply as a positive, as a friendly, as a sympathetic, as a warm-hearted human being. Sometimes the bodhisattva helps by encouraging people just to perform skillful actions. Helps them not to be afraid of doing something good. Helps them to observe the precepts. To offer food, especially this is so in the East, to the wandering monks. To cooperate in building temples and monasteries and centers. Sometimes the bodhisattva helps by encouraging people in the performance of simple devotional acts. Acts which are simple in form but so meaningful in content. Like offering flowers to the Buddha, or reciting mantras, or going on pilgrimage to holy places. And in this way, as the bodhisattva helps people, as he meets them halfway, as he learns to speak their language, there comes into existence the more popular side of the Mahayana, not to say the more ethnic side. And this more popular side, does not represent a degeneration of the teaching. It represents a kind of bridge. A bridge between ordinary, worldly life on the one hand and purely spiritual life, even transcendental life on the other. This popular side of Buddhism, of Mahayana Buddhism, represents a degeneration only when it becomes an end in itself, which usually means when there are no bodhisattvas around to remind us of what the meaning and purpose and function of it all is, or when the ultimate goal of supreme Buddhahood is lost sight of. When, in a word, people build houses on the bridge instead of passing across the bridge to the other side. Now, popular Mahayana is very widespread indeed. It covers, or at least covered, the greater part of Asia. We may say popular Buddhism itself is very widespread indeed. And popular Buddhism, and especially popular Mahayana Buddhism, often incorporates various elements from the indigenous culture of the country, the people, to which in the course of centuries it has spread. In India, where the Mahayana arose, it incorporated elements of Indian, indigenous Indian culture, belief and practice. And it did the same thing when it went to China, when it went to Japan, when it went to Tibet, and so on. And we may say that popular Mahayana is so widespread, or has been so widespread, has been so abundant in growth, so luxuriant in its development, that some modern scholars have tended to think of the Mahayana itself as an essentially popular movement. But this is a great mistake. The Mahayana certainly is a popular movement, historically speaking. But at the same time, the Mahayana is very profound. And it's not just intellectually profound, it's spiritually profound. And this spiritual profundity of the Mahayana is exemplified particularly in the teachings which center upon perfect wisdom, or as it's sometimes rendered, transcendental wisdom, or the wisdom that has gone beyond. Gone beyond, that is to say, gone to ultimate reality. And this ultimate reality to which perfect wisdom has gone is known technically in the Mahayana as shunyata, which literally means the voidness, sometimes translated emptiness. But it's not voidness in the sense of vacuity, not emptiness in the sense of vacuity. It's void. It is voidness in the sense that it is beyond all concepts, beyond thought, beyond the reach of the rational human mind. Perfect wisdom is sometimes regarded as the higher spiritual faculty that intuits the voidness, and voidness, shunyata, as what is intuited by perfect wisdom. The one is, as it were, the subject, the other, the object. But at the same time, in reality, from the standpoint, if there is such a thing as a standpoint in this connection, from the standpoint of shunyata, there's no such distinction. There's just one unbroken awareness, not divided, not bifurcated into the polarity of subject and object. And the bodhisattva has to develop perfect wisdom. It's that which makes the bodhisattva a bodhisattva. He has to realize voidness, realize shunyata, has to remove, has to transcend the distinction between self and others. And only then, paradoxically, can he work for others. Only then can he help others. So the bodhisattva ideal does not represent a kind of humanitarianism, not even a religious humanitarianism. The bodhisattva ideal represents the wisdom of the voidness breaking through into, functioning into the midst of the world, in the midst of the affairs of everyday life. Now we might think that because the Mahayana emphasizes wisdom, it neglects faith and devotion. But again, this would be a mistake. In the Mahayana, devotion is also emphasized. Indeed, in the Mahayana, devotion in all its forms some of them very colourful forms, is particularly intense. And that devotion in the Mahayana is directed not only to the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni, but to the ideal Buddha, if you like, the universal Buddha, the eternal Buddha, to the Buddha who occupies the centre of the spiritual universe of the Mahayana. Directed, in fact, to a number of different forms of that Buddha, different aspects of that Buddha. There is, for instance, Amitabha, the Buddha of infinite light. There is Varochana, the Buddha of sun-like splendour. And in the same way, the devotion of the Mahayana is directed to the great, as it were, archetypal bodhisattvas. Bodhisattvas who are, or who have become, streams of suprapersonal spiritual energy, like Avalokiteshvara, the Lord who looks down in compassion. Manjushri, the gentle-voiced one, the Lord of wisdom. And Samantabhadra, the universally beneficent. Kshitigarbha, the earth womb who descends into the depths of the states of suffering. The devotion of the Mahayana is directed towards all these great beings. So the Sutra of Golden Light is a Mahayana sutra. It exemplifies many of the general characteristics of the Mahayana movement. Exemplifies, for instance, its universality, its emphasis on the Bodhisattva ideal, its spirit of intense devotion, its plurality of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. But it also possesses certain special features of its own, as we shall see. But it's time we passed on to the second question.